Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk JCPenney as they kick appliances to the side. We'll talk solid earnings from Under Armour. We'll also discuss Sears and the big story that's on everyone's lips this week, Amazon HQ2. Big thanks to everyone out there listening and those who follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. Also, big apologies for this podcast being late for those wondering what might have happened. I actually took a floor ball to the eye and had trouble seeing my computer screen, so even if I could have read my research, I certainly couldn't have edited any of our mistakes out of the show, so I apologize for that. Eyes feeling much better. You know who else is feeling much better? Sears. We thought a resolution would come for Sears that would save around 400 stores, and Leighton, that's exactly what we got last week.
And I think the big question is going to be, are they going to be around for the next 2 to 3 years? Because the news is so good right now for Sears. They're able to stay around and hold on to several hundred stores. The court rejected Eddie Lampert's first bid to buy out the retailer or take them out of bankruptcy. But this time, a larger, more restructured bid of around $5.2 billion ended up going through. And there was a lot of backlash that we'll get into. Unsecured creditors, for one, raised multiple concerns, but they were turned back by the judge, as we think the judge looked at the immediate effects that would take place if all stores shut down. The unsecured creditor committee will actually end up filing a lawsuit, or supposedly file a lawsuit, after everything has been settled and streamlined with the company. The lawsuit is going to be seeking damages after everything, again, is settled, but they're going to be looking at the specifics of this settlement agreement, because there's a lot of stakeholders here that are not going to end up being paid from that $5.2 billion contribution. It gets extremely complicated, and when Trent and I were doing the research, we were laughing at the sheer amount of hours that were clocked for the lawyers on both sides of this deal. But you can see the unsecured creditors have lambasted the deal as, and I quote, a scheme to rob Sears and its creditors of certain assets. And so, in all, there will still be 425 stores left, and I think that's what the judge saw here, Trent, is that there's going to be a number of stores left, and if you were to liquidate entirely, so within, let's say, the next 4 to 8 weeks, take all of these stores off the table, you're thinking of a lot of unemployment. A lot of people, managers, store personnel, executives, they're going to be left without a job, and I know that's been an issue over the last several years because it wasn't that long ago, and again, we'll get into some numbers that we bring up from 2016 about how many stores they had then. It's been a slow, dwindling number, but you have to factor in those short-term economic effects, and I think that's exactly what the judge did here. That 425 number, by the way, is up from something we had talked about just a few podcast episodes ago when we had cited a number that was closer to around the 400 mark. So it's actually a little bit better for those company personnel, those people, those stakeholders involved, if you will. This will keep around 45,000 jobs active with the company. So that does give you some insight into just how many people are going to be affected or would have been affected if they would have participated in a complete liquidation. So Sears will end up having around 223 actual Sears banner locations and 202 Kmart banner locations, nearly half of which are going to be in California, Florida, Pennsylvania, New York, and Puerto Rico. And what's interesting, Trent, is since I now live in the Orange County area, I see a number, literally dozens of former Kmart and Sears locations. So it's interesting to me that there are still so many in existence throughout not only where I live, but also in Northern California. And a fun fact, by the way, something I had just alluded to, just 2 years ago at the end of January 2016, they had 1,672 stores. I guess that's about 3 years ago now that we're in 2019. But think about that. Roughly one quarter the amount of stores are still in existence. And this, when in fact, just 10 years ago, they had over 3,000. So they've definitely been dwindling down, really trying to get to a point where they say, where Sears' management says they can better manage costs. Of course, that's not always been the case. But the $5.2 billion bid was a joint effort between Lampert, again, the leader here or former CEO of Sears, and his once lauded hedge fund ESL Investments. ESL has, of course, played an integral part, as we've been covering, in Sears having been staying alive, really, for the most part, giving them lifelines of cash as they've been hemorrhaging hundreds of millions of dollars, despite having spun off Craftsman, Land's End, and a number of real estate holdings throughout the country. But all of these lifelines, it just did not bear fruit. But ESL played a huge part in this $5.2 billion bid. I believe Eddie Lampert, and don't quote me on this, is putting around $500 to $600 million of his own money in, leaving all of the other credit facility up to ESL Investments. The final bid was, in all reality, the only option that saved the retailer from going through a complete liquidation. So we say all of this to say, listen, this was the only option on the table. So you can complain all you want. And those stakeholders, those creditors, those former employees, those pension holders, they have every right to be angry at the management that brought them to this point and through every single earnings call was saying, we're going to bring this company back to profitability. It didn't happen. They've mishandled nearly everything. We understand that. But I think from the optimistic side of things, from the glass half full perception of these events that have occurred over the last several months, I think it's a positive. I think it's going to be a net positive, at least in the short term, that we can stave off a complete liquidation. Per one of the lawyers who attended the final hearing, the judge made a comment to Lampert, and you and I, Trent, this really struck home for us because this is really the truth of the matter. He said that Lampert was more or less putting his legacy on the line here in terms of where the company is going to be going in the near term. It's going to be very telling for the company's remaining stores what exactly he does, because they do have a little bit more of an agile balance sheet.
In order to rebound now, the company has to significantly invest in its remaining base. And this is something we've talked about for the last little while, is that Sears hasn't really invested at all in its base that was remaining, but rather has just focused on cost cutting. So there really wasn't a method to profitability because they were simply just focused on cutting costs. Well, eventually you have to reinvest in what you have left. And that's really going to be the key going forward. Now, the company's balance sheet will look much better coming out of bankruptcy, but they still have over $1 billion in liabilities. And ESL and Sears management will no doubt still look to close a few more stores, as they own several that were not spun on via Seritage Growth Properties. ESL said it also sees an opportunity to invest in smaller stores, like the new appliance-focused Sears stores opened in Texas, Colorado, Hawaii, and Pennsylvania. Now, these stores, a lot closer to the Sears hometown stores that you see with a lot of the electronics and appliances eschewing the clothing. These stores generally between 7 and 20,000 square feet, while a typical Sears averages around 138,000 square feet. So these smaller stores specialize in selling appliances, but customers can also order other Sears products within the store, and of course you get that buy online, pick up in store optionality. Now, this type of concept is similar to Lampert's Sears hometown banner, again, that I had just discussed. That has a franchising model, though, so it remains to be seen how it'll be spelled out on a corporate model, but that had mixed results. In some places, the sales were very high. I actually talked to a Sears hometown store manager, and he said their sales had actually gone up about 50% when you look at the last 3 years. So some of them are being very successful getting out from underneath the corporate Sears banner, but we'll see what it means for those corporate Sears stores that are now going to be potentially downsizing there. Overall, what this means generally is that they'll be shying away from apparel. Honestly, I think that's probably a good thing for Sears. Apparel is something that Sears has struggled at, struggled with displaying, struggled with merchandising, struggled with inventory. Do what you know best, or do what you can do best overall. And I think it wouldn't surprise me, too, to see, even though you're closing a lot of Kmarts that are larger square footage, it would not surprise me to see Kmarts maybe compress their square footage, sell off about half the square footage in the store, and try to get it done with a smaller footprint. I think we're seeing kind of an opening in the U.S. retail landscape for general merchandise stores with a footprint in between that of Dollar General and that of someone like Walmart. But in any case, recent statements from Lampert, who's actually for the first time really opened up to the media after the bankruptcy, he sees a concept that focuses more on tools and appliances for Sears and then can potentially sublet excess space in those larger square footage stores, kind of what I was speaking to already. to us be unclear as to who would be interested in some of the spaces. Some of the Sears stores that you're talking about compressing, and even some of the Kmarts, are not exactly in retail fluent areas. But, you know, someone like Ross or Burlington might be able to slide in there. And we've seen malls more than willing to split up old locations with a few different banners. So ultimately, it remains to be seen kind of their pathway to reallocating some of that square footage and doing so effectively, because that's the key. Anyone can cut their store size in half, but the key is, can they be effective doing so?
Absolutely. And you have to wonder, too, it shouldn't really look weird if you're the landlord trying to split up the space. So I think overall, in terms of what we're talking about here with Sears, if they outright own the stores, that is going to be a concern as well. If you're going to split up a Kmart, you don't want to have to insert a competitor into the space that you're subletting. But what analysts have already criticized from his recent statements in terms of his focus or lack thereof, let's say, with the Shop Your Way Rewards program, well, he ended up making some statements basically saying that they're going to end up doubling down on the program, which ties into their branded credit card, of course, that is backed by Citibank. So they've been trying to push this rewards program for many, many years now, saying that the rewards program is showing positive results. However, you still see declining traffic and declining revenues with both of their banners. But analysts have said that the Prime membership is maybe something they should try to include in their membership model in terms of something that they can charge the customer for. They mentioned Prime or Costco in terms of, well, a yearly fee perhaps, but we think that's not actually a good option for them, because if you think of other retailers like Ulta Beauty and Dick's Sporting Goods, they have rewards memberships that are tied to transactional history, tied to the amount that you spend on a monthly or yearly basis. Those are the types of transactions, especially for a retailer like Sears or Kmart, where you want to reward your customer base by trying different things to get them coming into the store more frequently. They simply don't have the infrastructure in place to be able to offer something like Amazon's Prime membership or the Costco or Sam's Club membership. So I think that's a pretty irrelevant argument. However, it's not necessarily a bad argument to say that it's been mishandled up to this point, because their creativity has lacked in terms of their Shop Your Way Rewards program. It's lacked a lot, and it's lacked in terms of implementation and sales force. If you or I were to check out at a Kmart location, granted, there's not many left, 202 locations, I highly doubt the cashier who's going to be checking you out at that point of sale is going to mention the Shop Your Way Rewards program. It's just not going to happen. And I think that's one thing that Ulta Beauty has done very well. You can't go into a single location without being bombarded with their reward signage. And especially if you go and check out at the register, that's the first thing they're going to ask you is, do you have an account? Do you want this purchase to be reflected on your membership? So I think that's where the energy really needs to be focused on for the company. And for Eddie Lampert's statements, he said really nothing of the sort, other than they're still going to go through and push that membership or that loyalty program out to their customer base or their remaining customer base. And lastly, regarding the loyalty program, some were saying it's pretty much a pointless system because it erodes margins. But you know, if you look at the basis, the transactional basis of every single company that has a successful rewards program, I mentioned two companies, Dick's Sporting Goods and Ulta Beauty, both of them, in essence, are eroding their gross margins, but it's getting customers familiarized with their brand and it's making them spend more per transaction. And that's actually something we've seen with Ollie's Bargain Outlet too. So just to say a blanket fact like it erodes margins, therefore they should not have it, we think is, again, irrelevant to the idea of a membership program. As it pertains to Sears, it's more of the execution. It's what are you doing with that program specifically that's not necessarily working out? Not that, oh, any membership program is or should go by the wayside.
We move on to our next story. Under Armour earnings came out and sent the stock up nearly 7% on Monday of this week. After a roller coaster ride over the last couple of years, Under Armour still trying to stabilize as a company. And honestly, I think Leighton and I have different viewpoints on the company. One of the companies that we kind of disagree about, I don't really see a long-term path to a big-time presence for Under Armour, whereas Leighton's a little bit more bullish, not much, but a little bit more bullish than I am. Now, the main story here was seeing inventory declines of 12%. something Under Armour has been battling and battling after losing some important sporting goods retailers over the last few years. So a couple of different ways to look at Under Armour here. First is, of course, their public-facing stores, their retail stores. The second, the manufactured goods that they're sending out to stores like Kohl's or Dick's Sporting Goods. We saw a lot of sporting goods retailers close, and the thought was that we were going to see inventory costs rise for Under Armour, not necessarily inventory levels overall, but inventory costs after they had to hang on to a little bit more inventory. And it's not just the inventory, but the company has also been criticized for having somewhat lackluster product selection and shoe designs that have been ridiculed on much of social media. Expensive deals with star athletes have also cut into the bottom line without bearing much fruit, leaving some questioning the strategy to go kind of all out with Nike by signing various athletes at very high prices for their sponsorship. And Chief Executive Kevin Plank, during this earnings call, said they are focused on running a smarter, faster, and stronger business. I quote that directly from him. This after numerous failed investments in tech, especially wearables. I think they were a day late and a dollar short when it came to wearables. They're a very important area of the market, but it's pretty much a one-and-done purchase if you're making them effectively, and if you're not, people aren't likely to repurchase that particular product. Consumers, one thing they're starting to pick up on is privacy concerns, not only with wearables, but with some of the household and other tech gadgets. So that's kind of creeping into the public consciousness as well, and it might erode some of that business that they could expect on wearables. Now, sales for Under Armour generally rose 1.5% to $1.39 billion. This is ahead of analyst expectations for $1.38 billion. I thought they were even going to come in below analyst expectations there, but instead, a beat on that front. And what's more, apparel sales were up 2%, but there was notable softness in other areas. And despite immediate positive reaction, the downside, at least as far as I'm concerned looking at this, is yet again failed sales traction in North America. North American revenues, despite all of these great numbers company-wide, North American revenues were actually down 6% year over year to $965 million. And we're at the point now where we're kind of out of the woods as far as some of the bigger sporting retailers closing that closed a couple of years ago. As such, it looks like a lot of this is basically organic sales fall off. And looking at the whole fiscal year, since this latest quarter was, of course, the fourth quarter, total North American revenue dipped 2%. Not a good sign for Under Armour, but globally, revenue was up a modest 4%, kind of counteracting some of that North American revenue fall off. Stronger international distribution is what they credited for that. Lower sales in their off-price segment and lower wholesale volumes were to blame for U.S. softness. And you go back a couple of years ago, Kevin Plank really began talking about trying to cut into their off-price segment, worried really that it was hurting their brand. They wanted to be in a premier space. They felt like some of their outlets, some of their off-price sales were eroding their brand overall. But it turns out, at least in North America, that's what some people were using to purchase Under Armour, because bottom line is, Leighton, they just couldn't afford the stuff at full price. And U.S. sales hitting around 70% of the overall revenue for the company, they have to try and solve for this problem of declining domestic sales.
Yeah, and you can't really have a business that's predicated upon international expansion. When you look at a company like Nike, their obvious biggest number one competitor here in the United States, they are just killing it on all fronts. You're talking about activewear, you're talking about casual wear, you're talking about, of course, their footwear division, just massively profitable, and it's growing at a rapid pace. A company that you looked back 5-10 years ago and said, wow, they have a crazy amount of market share. How are they going to be able to hold that against all of these up-and-coming competitors, Under Armour being one of them? But Under Armour has had a number of hiccups, and I apologize ahead of time because this story is going to be all over the place as we discuss their earnings details and what the company wants going forward. But I have to say, a lot of that is because of Chief Executive Kevin Plank, their CEO now and founder of the company, I should add, kind of being all over the place too. And he had mentioned, like Trent just alluded to, that they need to be able to be smarter, faster, and be stronger. But these are just vague, very open-ended terms, and you have to scratch your head and say, listen, we've been hearing that for 2 years now. And like Trent had said at the very start of this story with Under Armour, I for one, was once very bullish on this particular company, but I had a position in the company for about 2.5 years. I lost a lot of money on it, so maybe I'm more bearish now. As far as seeing their earnings results over the past year or two and the same statements over and over and over again, you really start to erode trust in your shareholders and in analysts, because at the end of the day, U.S. sales softness is still a thing in the face of other niche competitors like Lululemon and other startups, particularly in the California area, killing it with the exact same merchandise that they're selling. So I really have to wonder where they're going to go from here. But that all aside, we do have to go back to their financial status for this most recent earnings report. On the earnings per share side, the adjusted earnings per share hit 9 cents. It was around 5 cents higher than what analysts were expecting. So you go back to Trent's revenue beat. They beat on revenue. They beat on earnings. So overall, you can understand why the stock would pop this week when they released the official press release. But its adjusted gross margin expanded 160 basis points, which is a good reason for those earnings per share numbers having beaten analyst expectations. The gross margin is around 45.1%. Very good for them. Better gross margins, excellent news, right? Second straight quarter of margin growth. I say those two facts only to say that for the last 13 straight quarters, before last quarter, they had margin consolidation. So their gross margin was actually falling for the longest time. And I think that was their biggest hindrance, was really trying to keep their brand elevated in the face of dying retailers such as Sports Authority and the fact that their brand strength just didn't do what Nike was doing. Their level of marketing wasn't that great. Their social media presence wasn't that great. They spent a lot of money, talking about the bottom line here, on these long-term endorsements. And even though they have improved their inventory levels down to around $1 billion now, by the way, sitting on their books, we have to address the elephant in the room, which is their falling or stagnant sales yet again. Nike, for one, has done a good job for their direct-to-consumer platform, and retailers have been trying to keep prices low via promotion. So all of those up-and-coming retailers that I just mentioned, those small mom-and-pop shops that do a really good job of marketing online and perhaps only sell online or have only one or two brick-and-mortar locations, these are now the direct competitors of Under Armour, and really they've been keeping pace in terms of brand equity. And that's one thing that Under Armour executives have been pointing to as of late, trying to get back to their roots. One last thing regarding historical inventory woes before we move on. There have been reported problems with selling through Kohl's, an area much excited about, or an area that we were excited about when they announced that partnership initially. Also, shoe sales have lacked, even though innovation spend is actually up in that particular category, along with, of course, those shoe sponsorships that Trent had alluded to. Footwear sales is actually down around 4% for this quarter, and accessories were also down 2%. So we mentioned wearables. That would fit into the accessories category, and this is a category in which they had to write down a ton of one-time expenses because of all of their acquisitions regarding wearables and tech not that long ago.
So after all of the stumbles that we've kind of talked about here, the company is finally publicly acknowledging the brand perception, or honestly the lack thereof, and they're putting together plans to focus on performance rather than focusing on an enormous number of these celebrity endorsements here. And we remember the compression shirts that first got Under Armour Major League recognition. And by that, I don't mean Major League Baseball, which is another issue entirely for Under Armour, but the compression shirts basically going back to their roots. And Kevin Plank, after all, started with performance in mind, the idea of making a company that was performance over fashion, and kind of going away from that as the brand has matured. But going back to the early days with the company, he always said the brand was born on the field, meaning they need a renewed focus on user quality performance. While once a key trait for the company is not necessarily what some people want when thinking of what to wear, Matt Powell, for example, NPD's vice president and sports industry analyst, told Quartz after the earnings call, and I quote, "We ask people who wear activewear frequently how often they exercise, and 60% of people who wear activewear often never exercise." So you're talking about a target market that aren't necessarily people like Leighton and I who exercise a lot and play sports and that type of thing. You're talking about that athleisure segment, that key segment there. Furthermore, NPD found that less than 20% of people consider performance in their shoe. So you're looking at people like runners, joggers that are looking for performance in that shoe. Those aren't necessarily the people, the same people that are going to be purchasing those shoes from Under Armour. They're going to go to other shoe brands that are more hyper-specific. That said, everyone by and large cares to some degree about the style, not whether or not the clothing or shoe conforms to exercise, but they're really caring about the look. And in shoes, Under Armour's really failed on this step. They failed to meet performance specs brought on by certain hardcore track and field athletes, so it's pushed them to other brands like Asics and New Balance, for example. And their standard running shoes have gotten criticized because they're cheap. And then their shoes have really failed in terms of the design aspect of things. We've seen a massive backlash because of that design. So that brings us to this crossroads between how or maybe should Under Armour be perceived in the market. Nike has the inherent benefit of course, longevity. So there's a little bit of primacy effect with Nike, but they also have the benefit of providing athletic functionality and being known for athletic functionality as well as their style. And Under Armour has now lacked in both areas, as evidenced by, of course, their previous inventory debacles and U.S. declines in not one, but multiple categories across the board. And Plank on the earnings call multiple times said they're very aware of current trends going on in different sectors of the market. One thing to say it, another thing to follow through on it. And the problem is, as prominent apparel enthusiasts point out, they're identifying positive trends at a rate that is by far lagging their competition. In fact, up-and-coming brands are setting the trend, and that's an important distinction from catching or identifying a trend, which is kind of where Under Armour's at now. And Leighton mentioned Lululemon earlier. That's a company we've been critical of at times, especially with the leadership. But they've made some successful attempts at recently having a differentiated product that breaks into more of what Under Armour sells. Take, for example, pullovers and sweaters and jackets. Under Armour having trouble capturing those same trends that companies like Lululemon, who are really on the ground floor of these trends, are already on top of. To their credit, though, and rather surprisingly, I should mention, Under Armour management has identified innovation as an area that is lacking. They poured a lot of money into research and development and innovation, but just hasn't come through to them. As it relates to actual clothing performance, hard to think of many innovations that could be game-changing coming from Under Armour in the future. Now, innovation could and probably should circulate more about retaining and building on brand equity and marketing versus, let's say, activewear research and development, because again, that's only about 40% of your overall customers. The other 60%, they care more about look and feel than they do about how the materials perform. But late in looking to their outlook for 2019, lofty for some, but they did reiterate full year expectations.
Yeah, it's interesting to actually see the analyst statements from their outlook of 2019. They reiterated a lot of their guidance, and a lot of people were saying, whoa, we were actually a little bit surprised because we were expecting an even softer 2019. But for the full year, again, fiscal 2019, Under Armour expects revenue to rise between 3 and 4% compared to its 4% growth in 2018 and 3% in 2017. So again, these numbers aren't anything to write home about. U.S. sales, they're expected to be flat, but honestly, sincerely, we wouldn't be surprised to yet again see maybe some modest market share declines in the U.S., especially as, again, those niche brands really take over in time in large urban areas. Shares, lastly, shot up on Tuesday, ticker UA for the company Under Armour. So maybe investors have more faith in the company over the next 12 to 18 months than Trent and now I do. Shares did end Friday down, but basically giving away all of the earnings gains from earlier this week when they reported. So share shot up on Tuesday, back down to reality from around $21 a share, right around to $19 a share where they were at during closing on Monday, which, by the way, is still way up from around the $14 to $15 range where they sat in February of last year. So in February of 2018, they were about $5 less than they are now. The company carries a $9 billion market cap. Judging from that market cap, you can say that there is still a lot of optimism built into the stock, even though they've had their ups and downs over the last 2 or 3 years. This is still a company to keep your eye on, still going to be a fixture in the industry, but it's simply, to us, just not a massive growth proposition anymore.
Well, into the second half of our news section of our podcast now. JCPenney in the news this week because they're pulling out large appliances and more from their stores, which looks to be actually the first big move since acquiring a new CEO and a spot left vacant, of course, by the departed Marvin Ellison. Now, the news shocked some, including us, as the sunk costs must have been massive for the company. I mean, think about setting up each store, clearing out the square footage, the advertising, the online presence, which includes, of course, SEO money. And we know that it's not appropriate to analyze sunk costs as relevant costs. After all, that's one of the fallacies, if you will, in terms of budgeting, is putting bad money after more bad money. But in this case, it could be argued that potentially they didn't give the category time to mature and become self-sufficient from a profit standpoint. They had appliances in most of their stores for less than 3 years, some as little as 2 years, since it was a progressive rollout. Previous to the first JCPenney store getting them back, it had been just over 32 years since JCPenney stopped selling large appliances. But in the end, what's done is done. And now we have to look at the reasons why, and more importantly, as far as we're concerned, what they'll do to fill the space left vacant in each store moving forward. You go back to when they first rolled out appliances under Marvin Ellison. A lot of the reasoning behind that was because they felt like the clothing didn't need to be taking up as much square footage in their stores. They felt like they had some square footage to play with. And, of course, mass closures for Sears, closures at H.H. Gregg and other retailers left this hole in the appliances market. They felt like they were well-suited to capture because of that open real estate. Well, you've cleared out all of that store space. Now you're getting rid of those appliances. What's going to go in those spots moving forward? Again, you can only have so many stores within a store. The Sephora concept has worked out really well for them. What's going in those appliance spots? Well, as far as the why of why the appliances are getting the boot, as others have pointed out, some stores were more equipped to handle the influx of displays over others. Let's face it, a lot of these JCPenney stores are older. Not a lot of newer stores in their portfolio, and some sections of the stores in these older locations overlapped with appliances, so that led to rather questionable merchandising decisions. One picture, in fact, had dining tables mixed in with ranges. Another focused on a display refrigerator that was basically sitting by itself near a walkway. You also had kind of the logistics within the store, too. The people moving in and about the appliances section in some of these older stores. There was a hassle for some stores, we heard, in terms of getting the appliances to the actual showroom portion of things because the JCPenney stores weren't necessarily designed to move around these large refrigerators and ranges. But Leighton, the stores affected represent the majority over their 860 stores. We should keep in mind it won't affect all of them because a little over 600 have integrated appliances.
That's right. So we say a majority, but really it's close to around 85% of their stores have these large appliances. And again, because it was a progressive rollout, as Trent mentioned. So you really have to take all of this and think about what path the company was really wanting to be on 2 to 3 to 4 years ago when they were trying to achieve this rollout. I think they wanted to end up having a little bit more inventory than they did. At the end of the day, I myself was in the market for a range at one point in time. I was also in the market, if you listened to our podcast a year and a half ago, for a new refrigerator. And one of the reasons why I didn't end up buying at my local JCPenney at the time was because the prices were simply too high. And this is something I'll get into, but the prices were too high and the selection was not there. And so even when I went to the stores, I was actually pretty impressed with the rollout. They had great signage. It seemed as though, at least the locations that I visited, they had enough sales floor space to accommodate what types of brands that they did have. So it really wasn't bad. It wasn't all mixed in together and it wasn't all in a tiny space, if you will. So I was actually pleasantly surprised with what I saw, but they just didn't have the amount of selection that, let's say, Home Depot or Lowe's did, or even Sears for that matter. And so I think to try to take advantage of H.H. Gregg and Sears really going by the wayside and leaving the large appliance market entirely and trying to take those customers away, those customers that are still going to the malls, maybe still hopeful to buy a large appliance at the malls. I think that was a good strategy. And I think that was a strategy that you and I had talked about 2 or 3 times on the podcast as being a positive for the company. But I think the execution was off, and I think it was off just a little bit. And so I have to push back in terms of the merchandising that we saw from others taking pictures in stores from around the country. Absolutely, they had issues with merchandising, but it wasn't anything like Sears has had in the recent past. I truly believe in my heart of hearts that it was a product selection problem. They simply didn't have the right amount of SKUs and the varying prices within those SKUs. I needed to be able to find something that was on the lower end and something that was maybe having a little bit more to do with the mid-priced arena of the spectrum. So as far as pricing is concerned, if you went into a JCPenney or they still have appliances today, if you go into a store, it's going to be mid to high price points, mid to high brands, these elite brands. I think that was good in terms of maybe what they were trying to achieve 3-4 years ago, but I think what their core customer wants, think about their target demographic. It's a middle-aged female typically, or middle-aged people that have decent income, but they're not on the high end of the spectrum. So you really have to think about, who are you going to be selling these appliances to? Was it the fact that you're trying to bring in customers in a different demographic to make them shop in your apparel sections? Because that's certainly not going to work. You can't force somebody who's coming in for one thing to buy something else that they didn't intend to. This is not Costco. This is not a treasure hunt experience. So I think the execution was off just for a number of reasons. However, we do have to talk about the future. We do want to delve into the future. That's actually more important than the past as far as we're concerned. So talk about the poor merchandising all you want and the lack of profit and perhaps the margin pressure that they were facing from, let's say, the tariff issues that are still hyper relevant today. Because if you talk about March 1st, there is still that 25% Chinese tariff deadline hanging in the balance. And a lot of those large appliances, Trent, guess what? A lot of those subcomponents, those larger components, they come from China. So as far as furniture, the company said they're going to be exiting as well. A lot of that has to do with dining room furniture, but there just wasn't a ton of that. In terms of what they're going to do with all of this space, it is going to be differentiated from store to store because some stores allocated more space than others of these over 600 stores. So I think if you look at some of the company statements, you can get a little bit better of an idea where they want to focus, where they want to put all of their efforts in terms of the headquarter efforts, in terms of marketing to their core customer in replacement of these large appliances and some of this furniture.
The company statements focused on opening up that square footage for the company's legacy strengths in apparel and soft home furnishings. And the company said these are higher margin products, which is funny because that's what we were told about appliances a few years ago. But if you look at apparel in particular, that's one of the reasons why they opened up this square footage, is because they got in this inventory flux with apparel where they were holding too much inventory. Part of that is because they had too much on the sales floor and they had to fill out the sales floor to make it look full. And so it was like this spiral, and now the company is bouncing back to those apparel and soft home furnishings areas. You know, soft home furnishings, tough to argue against the inclusion of that. That's always been a historically strong category for JCPenney, and it has at least of recent vintage as well. Now, increasing traffic overall to the stores is going to be the main hurdle Jill Soltau has to overcome. But the whole reason why they brought in appliances and furniture in the first place was to bring in more, or to Layton's point or to Layton's reference, and perhaps different customers. But people have felt, including Layton, like their target demographic was turned off by having less of a selection of items they were coming to JCPenney for in the first place, whether that's clothes, whether that's soft goods. But the argument basically being that salon, beauty, and apparel ended up lacking focus because they were focused on the appliances. And thus, it alienated the few loyal customers that remained, mostly, again, according to certain metrics, middle-aged women. Now, the good news is that if they're looking to enhance their stores, this is the absolute best time to revitalize spaces that will be left vacant by appliances, since everything will already be in transition in theory. It could reduce costs long-term if they address some needed refreshing now versus just repurposing now and then refreshing it again at a later date under maybe different leadership. Now, the company is still burdened by nearly $4 billion in debt, but a much better position in terms of store feel and reinvestments than Sears, who, as we mentioned, have no other choice but to revamp both Sears and Kmart locations that are left standing in order to survive. Now, all that being said, JCPenney stock is still way down near all-time lows, closing Friday at $1.30 per share. Year-to-date, they're up for $1.14 per share, so we can, in this case, celebrate the small victories, up a little bit from that. Market cap of $410 million, which, again, we think is so low because of that lingering debt level. This is a company that's shown decent to okay same-store sales metrics. They've shown a profit a little bit more recently, but that debt continues to overhang the company.
Well, our last story is probably the one or the only story that you tuned in for. In all reality, everyone is talking about it this week. Amazon HQ2 no longer going to be in Long Island City or Queens, thanks to a slew of politicians that raised concerns about infrastructure and planning issues and about just plain money. And because the story was talked about so much this week, or towards the end of the week, as this was announced on Valentine's Day or just before Valentine's Day, most have probably heard the different angles about how Amazon is pulling the New York City plans. And we will end up looking to provide higher level discussion as to why the pullout happened, but also why it matters a little bit less for Amazon than maybe New York City. And we will begin with a quote from Amazon Public Relations, or at least their team there. They said, "While polls show that 70% of New Yorkers support our plans and investment, a number of state and local politicians have made it clear that they oppose our presence and will not work with us to build the type of relationships that are required to go forward with the project we and many others envisioned for Long Island City." And Amazon said this in a statement on their website as well. You can see it there. The company said it will continue to grow the teams it has already been trying to grow over the past several years in Staten Island, Brooklyn, and Manhattan. So they still have a presence there. A lot of employees actually still do business as far as service teams and other coverages there that they have within the city. So it's an important presence for them, probably one of the reasons that they were eyeing this particular district for HQ2 in the first place. And Amazon has been covered by us and so many others through their search for the new HQ2 over the past several months, over the past year, having been a very public process, Trent. And this is one angle a lot of people aren't really talking about. It's led to a lot of scrutiny from the people in the public, the normal people. We're not talking politicians that are in the limelight, city and all the other commissioners that are there, the county commissioners. We're not talking about a simple vote looking to vote for or against a specific subsidy for this HQ2 development. It ends up becoming this huge thing, talking about over $3 billion in subsidy. People start thinking, your taxpayer base, most importantly, starts thinking, well, can't this money go somewhere else? Well, subsidies obviously are in place to begin with to try to spur on economic development. But New York City, it could be argued, already has a lot of things in the works. Google, for instance, already wants to expand a number of developments in New York City and different boroughs there, spending millions of dollars. And so one could take a step back and say, New York City really didn't need this in the first place. However, we will go through some of the numbers here without really taking sides on the issue because we don't know all of the numbers. And that's what's so interesting, Trent, about this is because you're seeing a handful of protests throughout New York City with citizens getting worried about home prices increasing, traffic getting worse, and how government money could go to longstanding infrastructure projects instead of Amazon. This wouldn't necessarily be a direct funneling of cash to Amazon. This would just be reducing certain amounts they pay on, let's say, property taxes, and then other incentive programs that Amazon would have to give back to the city as well. So in order to look at this at a high level, we do have to kind of ignore those figures that we have no knowledge of. The people that would have the most knowledge of them would be the city officials there and the Amazon people that were working to negotiate a deal. We can say that traffic would undoubtedly get worse and that home prices would increase. We already were seeing an increase over the past couple of months. People were really getting excited. In particular, investors were getting excited. In the real world, prices were going up in and around these particular areas. And so those are real arguments. If you're a citizen in that particular area, yeah, those are real arguments. The New York City public transit system already leaves something to be desired. So naturally you could think that, well, guess what? Billions of dollars could be funneled into that and it would be better for the average citizen versus just handing it over to Amazon. So a lot of things got caught up in the mix, but in a recent hearing, Speaker Cory Johnson, again from New York City, said in his opening remarks that the city and state made a deal with HQ2 in Long Island City and agreed to give away at least $3 billion in public subsidy before they did their due diligence, basically saying that they agreed to it without really knowing the details of what they were signing up for. And to counter this, Amazon and economists have argued this week that the long-term tax base value is far greater than the upfront costs of that particular subsidy because they're, of course, bringing up jobs, Trent. They're bringing up a number of benefits that they could do to enable the city's population to do better and or at least to make more money and to give opportunities for those that feel like they've been left out.
And Amazon mentioned they were sent to hire around 25,000 people. The subsidies would be based on an actual hiring metric from Amazon. Salaries were set to average around $150,000, and many jobs would have come with upfront incentives. There was even a requirement for this quantity of jobs to be carried long-term for 10 years or more. And Amazon Vice President of Public Policy Brian Huseman cited plans this week to fund high school classes in the city and used the opportunity also to announce partnerships with LaGuardia Community College, the City University of New York, and the State University of New York, which would create, in theory, a cloud computing certificate program for students. And both, of course, would serve the clear function of funneling Amazon employees to Amazon, but also demonstrating Amazon's commitment to the community in theory. Now, again, this in a time when many already in the workforce either need or want to be retrained because of jobs that have been eliminated by automation or jobs that they can no longer physically do. And that's just talking kind of in a general statement, but unemployment, given where it's at, you're not seeing the demand for retraining like it was maybe after the Great Recession. Now, as Huseman delivered his opening remarks, TechCrunch journalists noted twin black banners were unfurled from the balcony in the audience, claiming that Amazon delivers lies and also that Amazon supports deportation. A lot of the negativity was brought forth by unions who, again, believe Amazon has been guilty of unfair work practices in the past, despite the fact that they note a company minimum wage hike announcement of $15 an hour and better benefits. Amazon did say also that they were ready and willing to not only help the different neighborhoods that are poverty-stricken in New York City, but they also committed to a strong diversity program when hiring individuals to work at HQ2. As a point of reference, families below the poverty line exist in 80% of the city's micro neighborhoods, according to a recent study. Now, going forward, Amazon, as Leighton mentioned, will keep hiring at its current New York City offices. They have a large population of support staff already. Amazon's New York City tax breaks were set to be proportionally larger than the Northern Virginia tax breaks. So this basically leads you to wonder, you know, what is Amazon going to do going forward? Because for the Long Island City location, Amazon was going to receive about $1.2 billion in refundable tax credits through the New York State's Excelsior Jobs Program if the company did create those 25,000 net new jobs in New York State by the end of June 2028. New York State had also promised $505 million in terms of a capital grant to reimburse Amazon for the costs associated with building its office space. But Amazon said, hey, you know, we'll stop looking for maybe a secondary location. That was the rumor, is, well, maybe is Charlotte back in play? Is Dallas back in play? Amazon said, hey, we're going to focus on those offices in Virginia. Again, $750 million in grants there, split across two phases for the Arlington County HQ2 location. The first $550 million is set to be paid out from 2024 through 2030. And again, it's hiring based on Amazon hiring the promised 25,000 new jobs. An additional $220 million would be given to Amazon if it added another 12,850 new jobs on top of that. Arlington County also agreed to chip in $23 million through a grant to cover taxes associated with hotel stays. Leighton, a lot of numbers being thrown around here, a lot of tax breaks. The bottom line is, though, that a lot of analysts have argued that this has become a tax issue, especially with the public perception of the subsidy negotiations. But the thing is, it was never supposed to start that way. It was all a good-humored search for HQ2, and suddenly it appears that there's not many cities that want the HQ2, or at least based on Amazon's asking price.
Yeah, and from the public perception, so from our point of view and from the layperson's point of view, it's rather interesting to see how this dynamic has changed over time, because cities were, they were trying to get together. They were trying to see what proposal package could they put forth to Amazon to entice them to come to their city or their municipality. And everybody was getting excited about it. People were doing Twitter campaigns. People were doing Instagram campaigns. People were doing fundraising efforts, trying to really get the attention of Amazon executives to get them to come to their cities or their boroughs. Now you can see that a lot of people are saying, oh, wait, part of this entire deal is to get subsidies. If you're going to develop or build a new building for a new headquarters, that's going to involve a lot of public works. A lot of money is going to go from one entity to another. But that is how for decades now things have gotten done, especially in New York City, by the way, where public works projects and subsidies and write-offs and these types of things surrounding real estate and headquarter development have been going on forever. So I don't know if people are just now realizing that that's how business is done, even though this was really a great deal. I'm talking in terms of the magnitude of the deal. We're talking over $3 billion in New York City, $750 million in Northern Virginia. We're talking about a lot of money here, but we're also talking about a company that now churns out billions of dollars and creates billions of dollars in terms of the multiplier effect for the economy month after month after month. And that really can't be argued. That is a fact. So building subsidies, while obviously important, like they were for massive companies like Foxconn, Ford, Nike in the past, are not always central to new development. So this kind of goes back to what we're saying with the original news of HQ2 being looked at in different cities, was a lot of people were really getting thrilled about the idea that Amazon could come to a community, or any company for that matter, because usually there's more than just subsidies, but Amazon in this case was talking about education programs. They were talking about public works projects where they would help those families that were underneath the poverty line. And this is exactly what they were going to do in certain areas of New York City. But that was up for debate as well. So there's so much that goes into this that I don't think the average person really sees. And to be honest, Trent, you and I really didn't see it either before we started to dig into the details, because there were so many articles surrounding this. If you look at every subsector of this type of news, you're looking at so many different angles for which to look at this. You're looking at the tech angle, you're looking at the jobs angle, the local economy, the people below the poverty line that are not thrilled that the home prices are going to be going up and that there's going to be more traffic. Think about that for all of the other cities that had campaigns out there. They're probably relieved now. I mean, they are probably looking at this New York City debacle and saying, oh, well, we missed this one. So this going forward really has to do with what kind of proposals they're going to do, or they're going to put in front of different cities to make it seem like it is a partnership. It is not Amazon getting one over on this particular community and hurting the citizens of this community. It's more about a collaborative effort. And a prime example of this would be in Nashville. The company has already offered 5,000 new job opportunities over the next few years. But you look at the news and, you know, negativity on the news, you could see a lot of people now protesting that because of some of the subsidies that were announced with that particular deal. But I digress. Very interesting situation with Amazon. Again, all over the news this week. Amazon shares, and yes, we should get to that, ticker AMZN. They've seen 52-week lows of around $1,300 and 52-week highs just over $2,000 a share. That's when they were over $1 trillion in market cap. Shares just right around that $1,600 level as of close on Friday of this week, around $210 billion off of their nearly $1 trillion market cap level.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final step of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look at stories we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. I'll actually go first this week, and it's because Target is actually pulling a reverse Walmart when it comes to their dress code. Now, several people out there will no doubt remember when Walmart switched up their dress code to include basically blue shirts and khakis, whereas prior to that point, Walmart employees could pretty much wear whatever they want. Well, for Target employees, they get a little bit more freedom now, as Target employees, it was announced on Thursday of this last week and repeated in a story by Emma Dill in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, that employees can wear blue jeans to work. So it really extends the look beyond the red shirt or red polo and khaki look that Target has had as far back as I can remember. So they're opening this up. They're treating it kind of as a way to treat employees for working so hard for the company. There's a lot of videos posted on social media of Target employees wearing jeans and being happy about wearing jeans to work. But at the same time, you wonder, you know, a small thing like this, what does it do for employee morale versus what does it do for the outside perception? And of course, I think the argument could always be made that, you know, hey, if someone's going to stop going to Target because people are wearing blue jeans at work, they're probably not Target's target audience, if you will. So you think about the way the company has marketed themselves. You think about the way they've branded themselves over the years. It's kind of like a happy-go-lucky retailer that's slightly more upscale with Walmart. And having a dress code like this kind of drives home that effect. So you wonder if this will do anything at all for their overall perception, if it'll help it, if it'll hinder it, what will happen to this dress code, and moreover, will it stick around? Because we've seen a lot of retailers switch up dress codes on the fly, and those changes haven't really stuck. So I'm anxious to see kind of what happens with Target and Target employees, and how many employees exactly take advantage of the dress code.
My looking ahead has to do with a company that, if they do what they say they're going to do, could have an impact on Kohl's for Under Armour, a company that we just talked about, or JCPenney, another company that has a huge mall presence. And I'm talking about Payless Shoe Source. They're actually set to shutter all of their 2,300 stores in the United States. And this comes by an unnamed source from Reuters on Thursday. The company has been on some hard times. This is actually their second bankruptcy notice. And honestly, Trent, this is a company we have actually had on our radar, a company we've talked about, I believe, twice on the podcast now for their different woes in the shoe industry. And this is a company that has a huge mall presence. We're talking about even some A-class malls that I've visited recently still have a Payless Shoe Store. So strikingly odd in some cases, but regardless, you're looking at a lot of locations, a lot of real estate that's going to go vacant now. And I know that Payless, not only do they have a mall presence, they also have a lot of standalone centers that, you know, are probably, or at one time, pretty valuable to some investors, because those single tenant, triple net spaces are pretty valuable for some long-term investors out there. And now you see them exit, or potentially exit, according to this unnamed source. So I'm curious to keep my eyes on that. But from what we can tell, they failed to find a buyer and they have to liquidate. So sort of a Sears situation, but instead of Eddie Lampert coming to save the company and their 425 remaining stores, they get nobody.
Yeah, you wonder what's going to happen, especially to the freestanding stores. Might be, weirdly, a little bit easier for the mall operators to fill spaces, because there are a lot of just freestanding on their own, not a part of a strip mall or anything, Payless Shoe Store stores still in the United States, and it's kind of an awkward square footage to fill. We'll see what happens with that. But that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Reminder, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back actually just a few days from now, because we're going to record our next episode fairly quickly here since we made you wait so long for this one.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.